Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's May 6th, 2018, and welcome to episode 171 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I like to know.
The RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, collecting, packing, shipping, unpacking, weeping, and so forth. So, hello, I'm Paul Hagstrom in Boston, and I'm joined today by two of the regular RCR guests, hosts, people.
Don't call me regular. Hailers.
Don't call me people.
All right, so first to have spoken is Earl Evans in Portland. How are you?
Hey there, Paul. I'm doing well, actually. I guess I'll have to talk about the weather since we do that every time. It's been a little on the warm side for, early spring here in Portland. Actually, I guess it's getting to be like mid-spring now, isn't it? Is it mid-spring or it's not late spring yet? Does this any of this really matter? It's nice. The weather's nice. Little overcast, but
sudden realization. Oh no, none of this matters.
I'm having an existential crisis. I'm good. It's good. We're good.
Excellent.
How about you?
I'm good. I guess we had just like 2 days of summer, but now it's back to sort of spring again. So I don't know. It's the weather is just it's interesting. That's what I'll say. It is interesting. It is not predictable. Carrington, how are you? Oh, yes. And also we're joined by Carrington in Toronto, Canada. Carrington, how are you?
I'm excellent. The weather today is a balmy 293 Kelvin or something. I don't know, something in that range probably. I'm doing well. Happy to be here.
And I've heard that Carrington is actually going to do an episode-long impression of Carrington. That's what he told us before we started, which is going to be really interesting.
I've been practicing my me.
Very Inception-like.
Yes, I just saw Inception for the first time like last week, so that's all. Again, does this matter? I don't know.
Well, did you like it though? That's the question.
I don't know. It was interesting. I think I liked it.
Did you watch it, but then wake up and realize that you were having a dream about watching it?
I did not. But actually, one thing that was weird about it was that I have, for, I don't know, 2 years or something, listened to the soundtrack as I work. So, like, I hadn't seen the movie, but I somehow had the soundtrack. And so...
That's a very strange life choice.
It works out pretty nicely because, you know, it's very... It doesn't distract, but, you know, sometimes it makes...
But I remember it as one of the first movies that brought in that whole... the thing with the soundtrack always go to... like those big loud horns. Is that on the soundtrack that you listen to while you're working?
Oh, well, there's a couple of them. A couple of... I think there are probably more sound effect-y things in the movie. But yeah, there are sort of like big moment, musical moments. So anyway, it was a little bit strange because the soundtrack completely faded away. Like I didn't notice it in the movie in a way because it was just like a little bit of normal. So whatever. Anyway. So do you have a motorcycle and a skunky smell?
I have one of those two. So yeah. So to bring people up to speed who are not following my Twitter feed, I guess, my girlfriend's dog decided to stand at a skunk and just treat it like a sprinkler, not actually attack it or move away, just open its mouth and say, "Give me what you got." And it was just very bad. There's still skunk smell
on everything and in everything many days later. And also, I came home that I think it was that same weekend. And on Sunday, as I drive into the parking lot, and I park, I'm in a condo building, so I'm parked on the third floor down, three levels down in an underground parking garage. But wasn't there was my motorcycle that was there when I left the room. I'm like, hey, where'd that go? So it has been found finally. Turns out somebody stole it, but they didn't steal it much. They stole it and took it around to another part of the parking garage, I guess to try to jumpstart it. But I had the battery out of it because I was working on it, so there wasn't a way to start it. So they just left it there. And then the person who owned that parking lot it was blocking called and had it towed. So it was a long time finding it, but I now know where it is. It's in a lot without a battery. So I've got to bring a battery and assess damage. I think it'll all work out. But it's a pain. It's a bit of a hassle.
That's weird. Yeah, I had gathered from your Twitter feed incorrectly that it had just gotten towed, but I didn't realize that it got stolen halfway in the middle.
And then towed. Yep.
So whether or not it's stolen is a matter of debate. I say it was stolen because somebody who's not me took it from my property. Isn't that stealing?
Right.
The insurance company is very clear it's not stealing, because if it was stolen in any way and any damage was done, I could have an insurance claim. So it definitely wasn't stolen. They consider it to not have been moved from the property. So even though it was in a parking spot owned by somebody else, it's still in the property of the building in which I live. So they're saying, well, it wasn't really stolen. It was just sort of moved. And so that doesn't count as stealing. The police say the same thing, but the police also are thinking like, dude, you know where your bike is. Stop bothering us. There's people doing worse things. So I get kind of what the police are saying, and I should just, suck it up, I guess. But there's these arguments, like I'm trying to make the argument, but if there's a bunch of damage, right, Isn't this from it being stolen? I mean, it was only stolen like a short distance, but like if someone breaks in your house and steals your jewelry and then just hops to the neighbor's yard and buries it, they still did take your jewelry.
Yeah.
They didn't take it far. But no. So it turns out, I guess, at least in Toronto, or at least with my insurance company, if something doesn't go far enough off your property, it counts as like an attempted theft. Well, I'm like, okay, can I make a claim on attempted theft? It wasn't really attempted theft either. I'm like, we're just going to play this game for a while, aren't we?
All right.
So there you go. Skunks and motorcycles. There's so many worse things that could happen to somebody, but whatever.
I guess that's
true. I'm a
little
smelly and I'm a little motorcyclist, but...
Yeah, still. It's something of an adventure, I guess. Something to tell the grandkids.
Exactly. Boo.
Okay, let's see. Are we done? I think we're done. All right, so the host topic. We have a host topic today. This is actually a topic that was suggested quite a long time ago on Facebook by Joey. So... the setup is this. eBay has gotten big enough that collectors with too little space, and as well as like non-experts and heirs and estate sale pickers and so forth, can make rare and interesting vintage computer items available to those of us who are interested in them. We can find them on eBay. But being good at finding things at estate sales is not the same as being good at packing things for shipment. And so the question was basically, what are some sort of notable or worst or whatever eBay or just general shipping experience stories that you've had with particularly in the vintage computer realm? And so, well, maybe we can just sort of go around. Earl, do you have any sort of horror stories of this sort?
I do. I have a story that really bothered me. It is probably, I'll say, well, actually, I'm just going to be unequivocal here, and although I didn't say that correctly, and just say that this is the worst thing that's ever happened to me in the retro computing hobby in all the time that I've done it.
Okay, I thought you were just going to say, full stop, worst thing that's ever happened to you. I'm like, look at the life of privilege
guy. Worst hobby thing that's ever happened to me. In fact, I came closer at this point than I ever have of just walking away doing a rage quit on retro computing. It was that bad. So I wanted a Commodore 128, this particular type of 128 called the 128 DCR, which is a Commodore 128 with a built-in 1571 disk drive. It's in a metal case. It's a detachable keyboard, really a nice unit. I see one on eBay. It is in great shape, and I go ahead and I buy it. I paid a little bit more than maybe the going rate for the 128 DCRs at the time, maybe a little bit more than what I'd seen some of the others going for. But this one looked perfect, and the seller had good feedback and yada yada. So I went ahead and I got it. When I won the auction, I sent an email to the seller saying, yeah, you know, here's my address, information, et cetera. And by the way, could you please pack this carefully? Because I've had other vintage computer equipment arrive to me broken because it wasn't packaged well enough. I get the computer, and the top of the computer has been packaged with packing peanuts and I think even maybe some bubble wrap kind of stuff, but set directly in the box with no packing underneath it whatsoever. So one side packed well, the other side not packed at all. And of course, the post office had done their best to test whether or not this was packed correctly. And the box has this...
The service they offer.
Yes, they do. Yeah, the mechanical shock test. Thank you, USPS. So there's a ding in the bottom of the box. I get the computer out, and that ding is, of course, also in the case. Now, like I said, it's a metal case. So the case is dinged up as opposed to plastic, which might have maybe just absorbed the shock. This didn't. At this point, I'm kind of incensed. I'm like, I told you to pack this thing carefully. What the heck is this? So I contact the seller, a little hot under the collar. You know, I'm like, what happened here? The seller gets back to me, has the unmitigated gall to say, yeah, I packed it properly. And when you told me to pack it properly, I thought you were going to be a problem buyer. And so I'm just shaking my head going, oh my gosh, what do I want to do on this? It turns out that I was able to bend back the metal enough where the case wasn't actually warped. The computer didn't suffer functionally from this. Nothing was broken. And, you know, I opened it up. I took it somewhat apart. I looked at it. I was like, okay, no functional issues here. But now I've got this big ding by the user port on the computer. Is this enough to make an issue of? And I tell you, I was just so shaken up by the whole experience and by the attitude of this seller that I almost thought, well, that's it. I'm not going to buy anything off eBay anymore. Maybe I'm just not going to buy anything anymore. My collection might be done. Wow, I've been taken advantage of. This just feels horrible. And I got to tell you, every time I look at the bottom of that Commodore 128, if I'm moving it around or something like that, that whole thing just comes up for me again. Like, not only did this person not pack it properly, but decided to cop an attitude with me when I called him out on it. So that's my worst experience with eBay. I got over it over time. you know, I I've bought things from eBay subsequently, and, you know, I finally calmed down. But I mean, actually, it probably took me a year or two before I bought any other vintage computer equipment on eBay. It was that frustrating. You know, the earlier case where I'd had something get damaged, it was an Apple II, and it got damaged because of poor packaging. And it turned out that it wasn't much of a problem. It was a small crack in the case by where the keyboard and where the cover pops off for the expansion slots and that. I was able to glue it back so well, you would never know it had been broken. So the only thing that bothered me about that was just the fact that the seller had not packaged it correctly, which is why I tried to tell people in the future, please make sure you pack these things. I mean, even if insurance pays for it or whatever, it's still a vintage computer artifact that now it's broken. And, you know, there. So a little tiny slice of history has been lost because you didn't take the time to try to make sure this got from point A to point B. But man, this seller on the Commodore 128, wow. Just, well, anyway, karma, right? So that's my story, and you're stuck with it.
It's amazing how the attitude it can make all that difference.
Yeah, and I mean, I had been nice when I asked them to the seller to package it properly. I hadn't come across with an attitude at that point. I had phrased my request in an exceedingly diplomatic way, and to get that kind of a response, it just kind of shocked me. I was like, wow, that's just, that wasn't very nice. Not a you.
Yeah, I guess it sort of seems like to be a seller and expect that, you know, somehow the buyer's going to trust you. Like, why would they, on what basis would they trust you to be able to pack this? It's not an insult to say, please pack it, right? Because there are a lot of idiots out there.
Yeah, indeed. And I imagine since this topic has come up that other people have, lots of people have had things damaged in shipment. It's problematic. Yeah. And I will say that whenever I've sold stuff on eBay, and I've sold probably a couple dozen retro computer items over time, I've always packaged them with the utmost of care to make sure that, you know, and never had anybody call me out on it. When it got to the other end, it was always the way it left me. So I think that's just part of being a responsible retro computer hobbyist, is if you're going to sell something, make sure it gets to the destination without being broken. Because like I say, even if I pay for it, I've still busted up something that can't really be replaced.
Carrington, have you had any sort of similar issues?
Nope, my life is charmed. No, I'm kidding. Yeah. Of course I have. If you've bought things on eBay, you've had things destroyed. That is an unfortunate reality. I have an odd background in this, actually, in that I designed software for a company called Planet Paper Box that was their back-end database and ran their machines to do die cutting and stuff. So I've done a whole bunch of things in the boxing industry, in the corrugate converters. So I can throw around terms like RSC and FOL, and I know the different box types and things. So like you think I would know stuff, and nothing would ever happen to me. But I have shipped things that have arrived damaged and felt terrible, and always done full refunds. And the two times I've shipped a thing, so I've caused the nightmare for someone else. The way I've packed the items, small items, is the way the guys at Planet Paper Box told me to pack electronics if you want to make sure it can survive what they call a four drop, a drop from 4 feet. So, which is, use 1-inch bubble wrap and put a minimum of 3 wraps around something. So you end up with really with 2 inches of bubble wrap. You put that in a tight fitting corrugate container, get another corrugate container that is at least 4 inches bigger than that, put a bit of packing peanuts in the bottom of it, put your first box in the second box, fill it up with the packing peanuts, tape it all up. So you've got item, 2 inches of bubble, another corrugate container, 2 inches of loose fill, another corrugate container. That's the only way to pack electronics. I have packed twice that level of packing and still had things damaged because of piercing. Something will pierce through and go farther than the 4 inches of padding, like a forklift or something, and go right to the item, and it's highly depressing. So sometimes you can't pack something well enough. This was not the case with probably the worst time I had something packed for me. I had, this is ages ago, back when I actually used to want to have this retro stuff. I'm kind of on the Earl side that he was going to go to, which is like, yeah, why do I want to bother with any of these things? I've long since gone there. Not because of damage, just because of minimalism. So I had ordered an 840 AV. It's one of my favorite computers I had back in the day. I had converted mine to an 8100. I made it a PowerPC, which really was a mistake at the time. I should have stuck with the 840. The AV computers are just lovely things. And the 840 is just a magical, wonderful device. And when I was getting back in the retro computing hobby, I was torn between a couple of vintage Macs to decide, well, which is the one I'd want? Do I want an LC475 or a 840AV? And I decided I wanted the 840AV. Very difficult to find one of these things, not crazily expensive and not crazily yellowed. Mm-hmm. The front panel on the sides yellow at very different rates, and so they become remarkably ugly. And this was long before I'd even heard about retrobriting. And most of the time when these things come up, they come up in the States, and they're very large, heavy items, and nobody wants to ship them to Canada. So it's a very rare thing that a very nice one will ship to Canada, let alone ship inexpensively. And this was a case where somebody was not shipping it inexpensively. So I bought it on eBay for probably more than I should pay for, but I really wanted it. It was incredibly expensive shipping, but nicely, the seller had reached out to me and described how he was going to pack it. And I felt very, very good about it because he was packing to a crazy standard, higher than I would have considered necessary. So that's why I opened with, here's how I pack. And this fellow was just going to pack the heck out of it. Massive amounts of wrapping and surface protection and bubble and a whole bunch of different layers of things, all in a in what's called an HSC, a half-slotted box. So which is basically a telescoping box. So imagine like you've got one box that has no top, and then another box that's the same thing, and they telescope together, making a big box that can kind of expand to a bunch of different heights. Because it's a big heavy thing. So you can put it, the big heavy item in the bottom box in a sense and slide the bigger box over it. Packs it like crazy, like just this huge box shows up, which is partly why it's so expensive. Shipped it, unfortunately, by DHL, which is like a company that hates freight. The one thing it hates in the world is freight. I don't know why it went into freight, because it's very angry at all of it. So the box shows up, and it's kind of, the corners are crushed in, and it's looking kind of rough. But it's not too bad. Like, I get to the DHL counter. DHL also never wants to deliver to a house. They say, no, drive out to an industrial area and we'll have it there. So I go out to the industrial area, and I had called ahead to see, is it in? Yes, because I had gone once and it wasn't there. I said, oh, yeah, no, it is here. So I swing by right at the end of the business day, and it's sitting over on the side of the counter, like on the floor beside the counter. And the box looks a little rough, but not too bad. Just a bit of corner crushing, no holes in it or anything. I'm like, oh, this is great. So I sign for it, say thank you very much, in good condition. I go over, I pick it up. And you know, like when you pick up something you think is going to weigh a whole bunch of weight and it weighs almost nothing. And so I almost fell over, because all that arrived was that top box. There were no contents and there was no bottom. What DHL gave to me was the top of a magic box that has no floor. That's what I got. So I guess, well, it was packed like crazy. The seal between the two boxes wasn't enough for DHL. And the bottom part, with all the computer and all the packing and all the floor and all of that never made it to me. I don't know where it got to, but it never got to me. All I got was the top of a box. It was very disappointing. So that was my worst one.
Crazy. That is crazy.
And I have this weird pathology now because of that. This is years ago, that if I receive a container before I sign for it, I kind of pick it up. I've got this weird thing I've noticed. It was a big box. It'll be on the counter and I'll kind of like touch it or move it. And I know it's because in my head I'm thinking, yeah, I bet it's empty. I bet there's nothing in there. Like once bitten, it's terrible. And the reality is I live a very charmed life. My friends have been joking that I will get my motorcycle back and there will be no scratches, but the saddlebags will be like full of gold doubloons or something, because things just work out for me. It's really, really sad. But this is one case where it did not, unfortunately. The seller did refund it, though, so I didn't end up actually costing me anything, which was very nice to sell. I didn't have to dispute or anything. So sad for the seller. But that was my worst. So I didn't receive anything. I just received the top of a box.
Wow.
I'm feeling pretty good about my Commodore 128 right now.
Yeah. Nobody should feel good about
it. At least there was actually a Commodore in the box when I opened it up.
Like, I've had a couple of other times where I got a LC-475 and it arrived like just basically cracked in half. And there's, again, the bad packing. But my worst is when nothing arrived. Like, look, most of the one box arrived on the outside. That's it. I got my label.
Yeah, the thing I was going to talk about wasn't this, but your story reminded me of, I think I probably even brought it up here on the podcast before, but at one point I went home and like sort of designated a bunch of things to have shipped to me, and so my mother sort of packed up a bunch of things, shipped them to me. There was like old notebooks and things that I'd taken notes, you know, like computer designs and things like this, and you know, just sort of a bunch of also I think I'd, and the thing that reminded me of this is that there were old bank statements, and there were some like old Time magazines from like 1982, things like this.
Old Time magazines, not like old time magazines,
right? Not old timey. You know, like Newsweeks and things like this. And so I don't know why I'd saved them. I think there was some story in them that I'd used for something, you know, like a little school report in elementary school or something. A somewhat similar kind of box arrived with like nothing in it. And because the bottom had given out, because the top was taped relatively well, but the you know, the seam on the bottom of the box was just left at whatever level of tapedness it had originally. And then I put a bunch of papers in it. Actually, I didn't do this, but anyway, somebody put a bunch of papers in it and mailed them to me. And so, it's, you know, it was somewhat sad that these notebooks were now gone. I had actually taken photos of some of the pages and things like that before they left. So, like, not all of the information is gone. But, and of course, you know, my mother felt terrible about it. And I feel sad for her, how terrible she feels about it. But the thing that was kind of funny about it was that then, not all that much later, like, the Newsweek got delivered to like my mother's house because it still had the label on it. You know?
That's and, awesome.
Like, my bank statements from college got delivered to my college. So
that's
like,
hilarious. So it fell, oh my gosh.
It fell into the mail stream again. So that was pretty wild. But, so yeah, and of course the mailroom at my college, you know, recognized that, like, oh yeah, yeah, we've been getting these now. So, but yeah, as far as eBay, I've actually had a really pretty good luck at eBay. I think the only thing that really got seriously, I've had some people pack things terribly, that still actually managed to be okay. But, I think the one thing that got the most mashed up was the, like an Apple IIc monitor. So it's like a little 9-inch monitor, green screen monitor. And it's, you know, it's got nice sort of like slatted plastic. So not super strong plastic for one thing. But then it comes with this like metal stand that is super, super heavy. And so, that was pretty much just put in a box with, you know, some token peanuts and like a couple of plastic bags and things, and that did not make it.
But, just a yeah. couple of token peanuts. It's really they just put in like here's a couple of peanuts.
Seriously, it was ridiculous. But yeah, so but I mean that was part of what I was thinking is that like, you know, it's one thing if you're getting this from somebody who is a collector and kind of like has some respect for what this is or like it was theirs or something like that. But a lot of times you find they're just people who've gotten things. You know, they went to an estate sale and they got a bunch of, like, you know, they got half of the computer set up and, you know, a bunch of old whatever board games or whatever was around. You know, like they're all they were doing is basically just trying to get things and flip them on eBay. And those are the people who quite likely don't particularly care that much about the thing and may well not know how to pack such a. Pack electronics because, you know, all the board games or books or whatever they've shipped in the past arrived safely. Mm. So,
and sadly, I'm seeing more and more of that, it seems like, on eBay. From the description that you read on some of these vintage computer items, it's pretty clear that the person who's selling it doesn't really know what they're selling. And that's okay. No problem there. But the problem comes in if, like you say, Paul, if they're not respecting it and packing it with the care that you would if you, frankly, had a little bit more clue about what it was that you were selling.
Yeah, I mean, there's a certain amount of opportunity you get if there's a super rare thing that people don't know is super rare. But
right.
Yeah, I mean, if it's just like some old thing from the attic of grandpa's house, you know, first of all, it may not seem rare because it's been around their entire lives. I mean, like, you know, it's this thing. Now they don't want it anymore, even though it turns out that, you know, grandpa had one of 10 that existed.
Mm.
So I don't know. Yeah. And I guess there's also the problem of people who don't know what it is, not knowing which things go with it and not knowing what differentiates it from the things they found on eBay that kind of look the same and were super, super costly, you know, so everybody wants to have a whole lot of money for this very common thing.
When I was doing my eBay research for this episode, I actually came across a piece of HP equipment, and it was half a computer that they were selling. It's, mm-hmm. You know, only part of what you would need to make the thing functional. And they even said in the description, don't really know much about this thing. So you could buy it and you'd have exactly half of what you needed to make the thing run.
Right. Though sometimes you'll see, you know, like Apple II sold as keyboards. So kind of goes both ways. Anyway. Yeah. I guess if anyone has any dramatic eBay stories, we'd be interested to hear them. We could read them out in our listener feedback section.
I want that guy who sold Earl the item to write in and tell us his side of the story.
Yeah, yeah, a rebuttal. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, I'd like to hear from him too, actually.
Yeah. Ready the knives. Okay, well, so we'll move on to listener feedback. So the last couple of episodes we've pretty much skipped over the listener feedback, and as a result, it has piled up greatly. So I'm going to run through some of this kind of quickly, and I think I will probably not talk about all of them. There are a couple of sort of corrections department things that have been pending for a couple of times. So one of them that I made a note on was that Mike Willigal makes an Apple One replica, and I'd forgotten the name, but it's called the Mimeo One. So I've now made that correction, and there'll be a link to that. And there was a Jupiter Ace emulator for the iPad that was recently updated for 64-bit, so it works in iOS 11 now, and I think that was a link that I missed. So if you're angrily writing an email, having listened to 169, thought that, you know, that we missed this link, and are somehow listening to this now before sending that email, here you go.
So we're not going to put that link back in the show notes for 169. We'll put it in this one. Make people look for it.
That's right.
I like it. Yes. I like it. I like the way you work.
Yeah, these are all pretty old now that I'm looking at this. In 169, we talked about Wolfenstein 3D, and I think I was somewhat confused about the existence of this on the 2GS, because I thought maybe it had been designed on the 2GS. But no, the 2GS was a port of the DOS version. 2GS port was in 1998, and the DOS version, as everybody knows, really, was 1992. So
I would like to point out that 169 was the episode, I just looked it up, where it was you and David Grealish. What did David do to our show? That notes are so messed up. Dave, right. Come on, man. You were here at the beginning. Don't mess with our show.
Right. It's true. It's all of the errors are from there. Anyway.
That's why we kicked him off.
Right. Let's see. Oh, yeah. So somewhere now here, I don't have the episode number, but we talked about Numberphile and Clifford from Numberphile being, you know, enthusiastic about something. And it turns out that the Clifford of that YouTube channel is Clifford Stoll, who is the guy who wrote The Cuckoo's Egg. Is this a book that's familiar to you guys?
Familiar. And like 3 years ago, my birthday present was I had lunch with Clifford Stoll.
Oh, really? Cool. How was that?
I don't think it takes much to arrange lunch with Clifford Stoll, to be honest, but it was amazing. I've been a fan since The Cuckoo's Egg, and you know, he's got this character of like kind of over-the-top enthusiasm and just like manic talking, and that is him. He is like that in real life, and it's amazing.
That's pretty wild.
Yeah,
that
it was
really
fantastic.
Excellent.
It was super, super crazy fantastic. Yeah, one of my favorite things that's ever happened. And he is a delight, an absolute delight of a guy. He is super. The whole time we mostly talked about things called Klein bottles. He's really into Klein bottles, which are these one-dimensional shapes. So it's sort of like a, what do you call that? What's that shape where you take a ribbon and you reverse the one side? So it's only got one side, but it's a ribbon.
Oh, yeah, like a Mobius strip.
That's it, Mobius strip. So imagine a Mobius strip, but as a three-dimensional shape. So it's like a bottle where the handle comes from the inside of it and sticks to the outside. And he makes these things. What? Right. Actually, I think he just collects them. He's just really into them, though. So we had long, very intense discussions about Klein bottles. It was amazing. Anyway, that guy.
Yeah,
I like that
excellent.
Guy.
Cool. All right. So if you had been on the episode when we talked about that, you would have recognized him immediately.
He falls apart when I'm not here. I'm just saying.
Yeah, that's right. But also, there was a Nova episode from a while back, but it's called The KGB, The Computer and Me, which is kind of like a reenactment of the story behind The Cuckoo's Egg. You know,
I've seen that, and Cliff he plays himself in it. It's great.
Yeah. So anyway, we'll have a link to the Nova thing in the show notes, and you should read The Cuckoo's Egg if you haven't, and you should try to arrange to have lunch with Clifford yep. Stoll if you can.
Yeah, I'm really jealous about this now, hearing about this, Carrington.
It was great. I invited none of you.
Nice. Well, not nice that you didn't invite us, but nice that you had the lunch. Yep. Information security is actually what I do for my day job, and quite familiar with the book, and it's, wow, that's wow with a capital W.
He's awesome. He's such a nice guy. He's like a truly, truly swell guy. Like he was so much and so enthusiastic and just like he is a character and he's great. I am a big fan.
Excellent. And I don't know if I actually mentioned this, but the person who pointed that out was Garrett on Facebook. So thanks. Okay. And then we talked about Errata Online, IRATA, not ERRATA. although this is in the corrections department section, I guess. Tom over email, who is in fact responsible for Errata Online, wrote to sort of mention that there is an actual person who manually creates the sign-ons. And like when we talked about it, Carrington, I think it was you that you signed on, but then didn't get a reply, but could log on anyway or something like that. There is actually some sign-on process. And he wanted to just mention that there are actually some sort of like online chat times, voice sessions, where he'll sort of go through and talk about how they use the system, what's going on about the system. It's just sort of like an online conference. And then he's anticipating having some workshops in the coming months on Tutor, which is the language, I guess, that things are written in, where they'll be working on creating some kind of multi-user game from start to finish. So
I should mention as well, there was a bit more about that that kind of popped up online, because I think in that episode I had said it's based on something, the Plato system,
right.
And I had never heard of it, and everybody else seemed to know it, and I thought, oh, it must be something that was like only at universities in the States. But then Quinn, I think she said on probably on Twitter or something, that she had used it at her, I guess, out in Alberta. So maybe it just either just wasn't in Ontario or just wasn't offered to me. Like maybe everybody was on right. it. And everyone's like, don't tell that guy. So I don't know. It's weird. I never had heard of it, never encountered it. I went to a bunch of universities, so but it was completely hidden from me. I don't know. I don't know what to say. I missed out.
Have you ever seen the Truman Show?
What are you saying?
Perhaps this was all just a big elaborate play
it.
Around to you.
I knew it.
But anyway, so I have signed on to it. I was not able to go to any of, in fact, I think even today there was one of those little info sessions, but I wasn't able to get to any of them, but I suspect they will continue to happen.
Although now that you also said the errata thing, I can't hear it as any way other than errata.
Yeah. Sorry.
That's going to mess with me now.
I tried to sign on to it after the last episode, and it took me a second because the terminal software you use, Pterm or something like that, has a default that you connect to, but it's the default connection is not to this system. It's to whatever, you know, the Pterm system is designed for. So you actually have to enter in the target. So
right. It does say that, though, in the stuff you download, I think, because I remember doing the same thing, but it does. So people just need to know to look for it, I guess.
Right. Yeah.
None of us had a problem with it, is what I'm saying, really.
Yeah. Yeah. It took me maybe longer than it should have. But
so I signed in, and I never played with it back in the day, never knew about it. Had seen, though, some of the historical stuff on it, like that piece that you linked to from Computer Chronicles, Paul, when you did the show notes. But playing with it, wow. I'm amazed at the capability that it had for the time in which it existed. You know, we're talking vector graphics, we're talking not really hyperlinked text per se, but kind of close to it, text that refers back and forth to itself in context. And the fonts that they had on there is just amazing.
The fonts?
Not the fonts.
Hey. Oh, the fonts. I heard it as the fonts they had. Done. What the heck are you talking about? The what?
Fonts. Yeah, they had the fonts on there. Hey, Errata's cool.
I was like, what are you? Oh, yeah, it really threw me there for a second, actually. I was like, huh? I am listening. Okay, sorry. Go on.
You threw me off. What was I talking about? Oh, I started taking a course on APL, the APL programming language on this thing. They, you know, because they have on this some of the old content from way back in the day. So, and I've always been interested in APL, but didn't know that much about it. So I actually started taking an interactive course on APL programming on this Errata Online, which I thought was just amazingly fun. So, yeah, if people haven't asked for their ID yet, they should do that. And the fact that...
Do you know what APL stands for?
I think I know the rumor. It's a programming language, right?
Yep, there was a book called A Programming Language, and that's where it comes from, A Programming Language.
It's got all the funky symbols, which could give you some hassle if you don't have a keyboard with those. But apparently, there was a mapping that they used on the Plato system that would let you type in with all the funky APL symbols. Anyway, just fun stuff. Blast from the past, literally. Well, I guess not literally. There were no explosions while I was doing this, but
yeah. Remember how we said we're going to just, there's so much feedback, we're going to fly through it? Sorry. Earl and I will try to do better at not interrupting.
No. Actually, this is fine.
Okay.
But we can save some of the feedback for later, too. And I don't think all of them are going to have this kind of like, not much to say about them. But
I do want to talk about that eBay one, though, because I think that's germane to our host topic for today.
True.
So just a heads up, we will interrupt you when you get there.
Right. Oh, we'll never get
there. We're interrupting you now to let you know we're going to interrupt you then.
I'll move forward a little bit and mention that Derek on Facebook posted a page which I thought was kind of interesting just because it's kind of like nerddom in two dimensions. What he's done is he's put together a page called Play Retro Baseball Video Games in Your Browser. And so what he's done is basically mined the Internet Archive for like online baseball games that you can play of the various sorts of the, you know, the old types, and kind of like compared what they could do. So there's like, you know, baseball games from the 80s and, you know, from the 90s, and he's just sort of evaluating them against each other in a way that you probably could have done back then. I don't know if anyone would have done, but the thing that's cool now is you can actually, these are all things that you can play right at the time. So this is actually kind of like the vision of why you would put these emulated things, you know, on the Internet Archive, why you can do these emulations in a browser. So you can have little stories where you compare things and try them right away. Don't have to set up any emulators or configure things or what it download stuff. So this is, you know, a proof of concept perhaps. And also, you know, if you were interested in retro baseball games, this is also good for you for that purpose too. So anyway, I don't know if any of you looked at this, but I thought it was kind of neat. You know, it's a neat thing by itself, but it's also diving very deep in two different ways. Okay, well, let me jump straight to the eBay thing. All right, so the eBay thing that was referred to before was actually that Andy wrote to us over email fairly recently. We had a little bit of an email response discussion actually directly, but he was wondering when we get to the eBay part of the show, like, how do we know how valuable something is? You know, like, what when we're critiquing things for being too expensive or whatever, you know, on what basis do we give something a value? Is there some sort of like vintage blue book we're consulting or whatever? So Earl, did you have something that you wanted to like jump in and say about that?
Well, you have purchased more things off eBay than I have over time, Paul.
That is true for every version of I.
Your response to this is probably more germane than mine, but I'll just say, you know, we're just taking a shot in the dark because we've looked at things that have sold over time on eBay in a particular category, a particular machine, a particular device, whatever. And you just kind of get a sense for what it might be worth. But I think this came up in the email discussion too. For a particular item at a particular time, you can't really know what it's worth, because what it's worth is the combination of who knows about it, of those people who know about it, what is somebody willing to pay for it, what's their budget at the time, did something happen in the news, for instance, to make a particular brand or something a little bit more conspicuous than it was yesterday. There's just so many variables that, and no, we don't have any kind of secret sauce. You know, there's no blue book reference or whatever that we're looking at. We're just doing our best to, you know, give a feel for what something might be worth. I mean, there's some absolutes. If a Commodore 64 comes up for $10,000, I can tell you that unless there was something stupendous about that particular one, no, it's not worth $10,000. If an Apple I comes up and it's selling for $50, I can tell you if it's real, you should probably grab it. But I mean, aside from those silly extremes, you know, it's just a sense. Is that kind of what you would say, Paul?
Yeah. Well, yeah, that sounds about right to me. Like that, it is true that I feel like I get a sort of a feeling for what something is worth, you know, when I'm looking at it just based on, you know, whatever, you know, the expert system neural net that's going on in my head, right? That I've seen examples, I've seen results, and they somehow gives me an intuitive feeling about like whether this is about the right price or whatever. But it's, I mean, this is the thing that actually makes it so difficult for like the people who find the thing in their basement or whatever to post, because like if you just search eBay for things that are like this, the things that make something expensive or not expensive, you know, they're not, it's not just the name of the thing, you know, so is it in good shape? Does it have a, like a very rare card in it? But like for, you know, for like video games and things, you know, is this the one very short, rare run, or is this like, you know, the one that was mass produced later? You really have to be an expert to know all those variations. There was a kind of a similar discussion that came up in the context of something on the one of the Facebook groups, I think, not ours, but because I think somebody was suggesting that maybe there should be some kind of rule, you know, some sort of like angry suggestion, like, you know, these eBay sellers, they should have to prove that this thing is rare by saying, you know, that this is one of 30,000 that was made or something like that. You know, it's like, but the thing is that there's no resource for that. There's the only people that are going to know this are the people who are the buyers, you know, so the only way they can sort of weigh in on what this is worth is by bidding. Right.
Right. And as frustrated as I get by the rare and look with zeros and the all caps and the other crazy things that people do to try and get your attention, I don't think you could really impose any sort of system to, right, you know, to validate that. I mean, this isn't like coin collecting where there are actual associations, numismatists who, you know, look at this stuff and grade it with computer systems and that kind of thing. It's just, and the other thing that I want to make clear is when we talk about the eBay auctions, we're not in any way trying to pass ourselves off as appraisers or put our opinion above that of the crowd, right? I mean, I think it's really important to make that clear. It's probably no better place that IMHO, you know, in my humble opinion, is what is all this is. And so take it for what it's worth.
Although all the medical advice you can trust that we give you.
Absolutely.
But yeah, no, I think that was one thing that came up too in the Facebook, you know, like the thing I was talking about before, that if there was going to be some way to sort of like appraise this, then there would have to be some sort of, you know, certification, and people would have to pay to get certified, and people would have to pay to get things certified, and you know, there'd have to be some consequence if you gamed the system. You could lose your certification and invalidate your previous appraisals, and like there's just no way, you can't make this work in such a small little thing. You know, if it were for coins or even like baseball cards or something, you could imagine something like this, but it's unrealistic to think that there could be any control.
And I certainly hope vintage computing never gets to that point. I enjoy it as just a hobby. I know there's a little bit of room for profiteering and speculation and that kind of thing on some of the more rare items, like the Apple One I mentioned earlier. But just in general, man, I just hope it never gets that complicated, because we're just in it for fun. Mm.
And the reality is, the best advice I could ever give to anybody about buying any of this stuff is the longer you wait, the better. Partly because if you go to eBay and you don't know what something should be worth, just like make a search for that thing. So you're interested in picking up a particular item, just watch for 6 months mm-hmm. and see what things sell for. Then you'll know what they basically sell for. And you'll say, oh, this thing normally sells for $40. If you can get it for 30, you now know it's a bargain. And so that will tell you what something's worth. And also, this is not a thriving hobby that's growing. It is dying. Literally, we're all old, and everyone interested in this stuff is going to die off sometime in the next 40 years. Like, there will be, all of this is worth nothing within 50 years, except for a handful of things to go into museums. So the longer you wait, the more people that have spent a ton of money on these things will die. Their collections will be dumped on eBay. You can pick it up for cheap. So if you wait, you can get all of this for next to nothing, including Apple Ones.
This ray of sunshine brought to you by Carrington.
Yeah. It's all just worth what because we want it, right? It's like a nostalgia thing. I want this stuff too, but it's because like people of a certain age have nostalgia for it and a bunch of money and a bunch of free time, and so we're just buying this stuff up. But it's just like an artificial bubble of value. Like, none of this has intrinsic value. I guess in a sense nothing has intrinsic value, but we don't have to go there. But the reality is, like, these things will come on, and the same item will be on eBay for $20 or $2,000. It's like, well, maybe they're both worth that. Maybe one's worth, like, it's all just totally made up stuff. So it's kind of worth what you're willing to pay for it. The longer you wait, the cheaper you can get it. But you also have to wait. And how long are you going to want these things? Like, if it's a thing you're going to enjoy, and you end up paying an extra $100 on it if you have the money and it doesn't cause, like, you shouldn't buy anything that's going to cause financial impact on you. But if it's all just disposable income, and you, so what if you could have got it cheaper later? Maybe you say, I don't want to wait. I want to play with that thing next week. In which case, drop the money and be happy. Just once you buy a thing, no longer look for it on eBay, because you'll always find one that sells for half the price you did.
So just great advice.
Stop looking and you'll be fine, right? So whatever, have fun, buy what you want. Don't buy too much stuff. Just none of it's worth anything, so who cares? Just don't die with a lot of money. Just, you know, die with some stuff. I don't know.
Your heirs will appreciate that greatly.
My advice is terrible. I don't know where my motorcycle is.
Yeah. No, I think that that's... I think you hit all the points that I wanted to hit, actually. I approve of all the things you said.
I will not repeat them. I approve this message.
Okay. That seems like a good place to end the feedback. So we have a lot of feedback. Next time you'll hear some of it. Feel free to write us more.
And by the way, it's a great problem to have so much feedback that we have to cover it over multiple episodes. So please keep it coming in, because we love to hear from you guys.
Indeed. All right. So let us move to items of interest and news. And Carrington, you will start us off there.
I've got something about Fortran, which I think is another one of those languages Earl likes, right? Earl, you're into fourth. Oh, Fortran. Okay, I know you're into one of those with an F.
I like them both. I've tried to do some stuff, more stuff with fourth, but I like Fortran. It's the first language I learned.
Oh, neat. Okay, well, Fortran has made the news, and not Fortran with a capital F, Fortran with a capital Fortran. So the earlier versions of Fortran was all caps.
Mm-hmm.
Later versions, I think starting with maybe Fortran 77 or somewhere around there, it became Fortran, just a capital F, a low Ortran. So it really caught my eye when the register.co.uk did an article about saying NASA, also all capitalized, dusts off Fortran manual, all caps. So I'm like, oh, okay. So if they're following, you know, there used to be this thing called journalism. It's
right,
pretty
standards.
Much dead. But there used to be people like that had like standards of how you do things. And the fact that these people wrote Fortran all caps really caught my eye. And it was correct that they did so. So there was... People might remember the Galileo, not the dude who upset the church or whatever, but like the spaceship, who might have also upset the church. I don't know. It was spit out of the space shuttle back in, I think, 1989, and did a bunch of space things, and eventually was just slammed into Jupiter. Like, so that was the life of Galileo. Poor Galileo. While it was up there doing its Jupiter thing, it... got a bunch of info from some of Jupiter's moons. Now, I know Jupiter has something like, I think by current count, 700 billion moons, something along those lines, and something like 60 of them or something have names, and then there's, I don't know, it seems like every week they find some other thing, well, that's a moon. I think some people are really upset about Pluto never having been a planet. I'm taking that stance. And they say, oh yeah, well then there's another moon of Pluto, or another moon of Jupiter. I don't know why Jupiter has 10 billion moons. But there's the big ones, Europa, Io, Ganymede, and Callisto, and Galileo did a bunch of things, swooping by those, taking photos, hanging out, making chat lines, all that kind of stuff, and then got itself slammed into Jupiter. Well, turns out, and this is a thing I didn't know, it collected a metric load of data, and Io, being the really exciting one because of all the sci-fi stories about how, hey, well, Io is really going to be a planet and blah, 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 and look at them, it's got volcanoes, and Io's the really fun one. So lots of the data from Io got published, got looked at, it was really a lot of interest in it, but most of the data from Galileo, including lots of the stuff about Europa, Ganymede, and Callisto, basically, nobody's even looked at it. It's just sat there. It's been 30 years, and nobody's looked at it. Well, another spaceship is going to be coming by soon and kind of going by Ganymede. And they say, oh, wait, hold on. I think we've got a bunch of info on Ganymede. We haven't even looked at it. And this is why it's important to keep backups and ways to run old software. So they said, let's look at our Ganymede data. Oh, we can't. It's all in some weird data format that can only be read by an obscure old version of Fortran, and we don't have obscure old versions of Fortran or any computers that can run it. So they had to dust off an actual old computer, an old VAX machine, to get a 30-year-old version of VAX Fortran running so they can look at this super old data from Ganymede and get somebody in to figure out, well, what is this stuff we have? And so that happened really recently. And so it's super retro. It's like, this is very much on point for our podcast. And so they're basically, NASA had to find somebody who could use Vax Fortran, had to find a computer that could run it, and are now looking through a bunch of old data from Ganymede so that they don't duplicate things, and they also know what is missing from the data holes. But one of the big takeaways from this is that same info, massive piles for both Europa and Callisto, is not being looked at. So that will just sit fallow, and maybe somebody another 30 years from now will want to look at it. And how the heck are we going to do that? So that is the state of retro computing in all caps NASA at the moment.
Excellent. This is somewhat tangential, but when I saw the mention of Ganymede, there's a sci-fi show that's kind of running now called The Expanse. I don't know if anybody knows.
Oh yeah, good books.
But yeah. Oh, is it? It's based on a book series.
Mm-hmm. Everything's based on a book series.
Ah, okay. Well, Ganymede was like a farming establishment of some sort, and got attacked, and there was a Ganymede incident, and it's sort of a central issue in the plot at any rate.
Anyway, the books, James Corey, I have read the first three of them. Leviathan Wakes is the first book in it's the Expanse series, and they're really, really, really good.
Okay.
That's why I watched the TV show, which I also quite like, but I watched it because I was like, oh my goodness, this is such a good series of good, hard sci-fi. I wonder if this could possibly be made into, will they make it as good as the books? And they certainly have. I really like it.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I know. I like it and didn't realize that there were books behind it. And perhaps that's why it's good, is because, you know, someone actually took the time to think it out rather than, like, try to work on next week's episode while this one's airing.
Yep. And the series is pretty much following the books.
Excellent. Speaking of Kickstarters for Commodore things, Earl.
Oh, good segue. That was so smooth, I didn't even notice you'd done it. You pivot like an Aikido master, Paul.
Thank you.
Okay, so Brian Bagnall, who wrote the book on Commodore history and then wrote another book on Commodore history, is writing the third and final book, and there's a Kickstarter for it. And I guess the news here is that the Kickstarter didn't just fund what he needed for the book, but has passed first one and then the next of the stretch goals for this. So,
yeah, it looks like there was a stretch goal for a foil-stamped spine.
That's right.
Sewn binding, so I guess the book is physically... Oh, there's going to be 8 pages of color photos now that it's reached 60K. And then at 70K, it's a Commodore pen. I don't know what that means, unless it's like an actual pen.
Yeah, I think that actually comes with the book then, if they reach that. I'm having a really hard time finding this in the show notes. Where the heck did this go? Oh, here it is. Finally. I apologize. I'm scrolling all over the stinking place. Okay. I can speak to this now. So I'm glad that this Kickstarter is doing so well. I don't know exactly when the book's going to come out. Also note that the money is Canadian, so it's funny money. Oh, thank you very much, Carrington. Carrington increased the font by about 50x.
I put it to 60-point and highlighted in yellow. Is that enough for you, Gramps? Can you see it now?
That's right.
I can see it now from the other side of the room. Thank you very much.
So maybe... Can you donate in Canadian Tire money or whatever that is?
Yeah, so it's funny money. It's the Canadian money, so a little less if you're in the U.S. You get a little bit of a kickback discount there. And if you look over on the right-hand side of the Kickstarter, there are various reward levels that you could take advantage of, including one where you can actually get your name in the book as one of the, what would you call it? A person who got their name in the book. That's what they call it. So this is really exciting. I just wanted to point it out, and we'll have a link up in the show notes if you're interested in this. And of course you are. Because it's Commodore history.
How much does it cost to not have your name in a Commodore book?
Maybe you can pay to get someone else's name. I'd like to remove Earl's name.
Exactly. See, that's how you get bidding on a Kickstarter. Earl's bidding it up and we're bidding it down.
Oh, that's, yeah, I see. It says it's actually, they were asking for 19,000 something, and it's reached 53,000 something.
Well, that's the weird thing is the Kickstarter seems to be in Canadian dollars. They were asking for 25,000. Yeah. So... is that just so that most people who fund Kickstarters are in the U.S.? Is it so that nobody really knows what their pledges. They're like, I don't know. It said $27 Canadian. That's like nothing, right? So maybe that was the sneaky way he hit all his goals.
That's like $3.
It's like psychological, yeah. Like the 1999.
Exactly. I tip my hat to you.
All right. Well, so I guess I have the next thing, which is the announcement of the Transwarp GS V1.0 from Ultimate Micro. This is now available for pre-order, and I think they actually made the. I'm not exactly sure what the status of this was before. It's been revived from an old project, but I don't think it was ever fully released before. The thing about this that's interesting is basically just that this card, it's an accelerator card for the Apple II GS, and the conventional wisdom about the Apple II GS is that you really want to have it accelerated. I mean, it's a nice machine and all, but a lot of the stuff that you would want to do with it is made much better with an accelerator. And the thing is that accelerators were available. There was the Transwarp GS and the Zip GS were both accelerator cards for them, but they held their value quite well over time. So they, you know, cost hundreds of dollars, even if you can find them, because they're rare and desirable. And so this is a good thing that Reactive Micro, or Ultimate Micro, is selling them. They're pre-orderable now. They're expected to be deliverable in mid-July, and they are $400 at least at this pre-order price. So fully assembled, ready to use. $400 is not cheap, but it is cheaper than you can find them in like their actual vintage sorts. So that's good news. I thought that would be worth mentioning. So if you were going to sell your Transwarp, it's conceivable that the bottom fell out of the market.
Not that we're experts.
Yeah, right, exactly. I have exactly one Transwarp, and I'm going to keep it, so. But it's conceivable that I might get one of these at some point, the remakes. The of course, being made of modern things, they are more likely to be reliable longer, too, I suspect, these new...
It's conceivable you'll get one. You keep using that word. I do not think it means what you think it means.
Yeah.
I think the word you're looking for is inevitable.
Yeah, right. They also, at the same time, announced a Apple II 3.5 drive controller card that they're similar, kind of like a remake of an existing thing. This is a card that Apple made briefly. They were super, super rare. I mean, like, not many of these existed, but the thing that they do is drive a high-density 3.5-inch floppy drive. So you can use this to have, like, massive amounts of storage on your Apple II. Apple did make them, but they made them very late in life, in the life of these machines. And so not many sold, not many still exist. And they also are those super expensive things if you ever find one. I have one, and the reason I have one is because I spotted it sitting in a slot in an Apple IIe that was sold on eBay. You know, like, it wasn't announced as being there. I snuck away with it, basically.
Ooh.
But advertised as its own thing, they are generally out of reach. So anyway, these are interesting developments in the world of the Apple II peripherals. And perhaps we have scooped Open Apple.
I hope so.
Come to think of it. I forget that I should avoid the Apple-based stories for that reason.
No,
but
we should not. We should embrace those and top of the show, just in case they put out at the same time as us.
Yeah.
We can beat them by a few minutes, and that still counts.
Right. All right, we can move on. Carrington, you have the next thing.
Speaking of Apple II stories,
yep.
Well, I guess in a sense this is. So,
sort of is, yeah.
Three people wrote Oregon Trail, a game I am remarkably unfamiliar with. This is another thing that everybody seemed to play as a kid and was not even exposed to me as a child. So I have only the vaguest knowledge, really, and that I've developed in late in life on Oregon Trail. No nostalgia for it, never played it as a kid at all. Three roommates, Don Rajic, probably pronounced that wrong, Bill Heineman, and Paul Dillenberger, created Oregon Trail, a text-only game. I did not know that the Oregon Trail that was the massive hit for Mech was a remake. This is completely news to me. So the massive blowout, runaway success graphical game created by R. Philip Bouchard, was a remake of an existing text-only game. Totally news to me. And I discovered this because very recently, a bunch of things have come out on Oregon Trail because that little game came out, and so a bunch of stuff, the little handheld game has come out, so a bunch of stuff has popped into the news. One of which is a book by R. Philip Bouchard called You Have Died of Dysentery, The Creation of the Oregon Trail, and that is currently available as like a real book and a Kindle edition. Not the Kindle editions, not real books, but you know what I mean. And also, he wrote something on Medium, basically based on the book, same sort of thing distilled down, and it's an article called How I Managed to Design the Most Successful Educational Computer Game of All Time. But of course, he designed the version we know. Very, very, very humble. But the article's written, it's a little tongue-in-cheek even. I think the title is a bit of clickbait. The article even says, okay, like, and it does acknowledge that, but only kind of vaguely acknowledges, oh, you know, it did already exist as another thing, but it kind of glosses over the fact that it's a remake. And I never knew that. So these, if you're interested in Oregon Trail and you're not like kind of sick of it because it's been making the news so much, there is both a book you can read by the guy who did the remake, this really interesting article, and the stance he's really taking is the way he wrote, way he rewrote the most successful educational computer game of all time was to not write it as an educational game. So I guess Mech was very much known for educational titles, so that's what they did when they got either the rights or just, it seems they just decided to do it, I guess, because it was just... The code for Oregon Trail was just out there. It was just like a basic port already by somebody else whose name is lost to history, it seems, for the Apple II. And then they made this version, which was a complete ground-up rewrite with graphics. And his approach to writing this and the mandate from Mech was to write it as a home computer game, not something for education. So they want to write basically their first home-targeted game. So that has a very different mandate than an educational game. One of the big things they were really looking for was replayability, like make a game that you can go through a bunch of times. And I guess the thinking at this time was an educational game is something that gets exposed to people in a classroom, they use it once, and it gets replayed in that the next year people come to it new, but the game itself doesn't really need to be replayed. Whereas with Oregon Trail, really tried to make a game that somebody would want to go through themselves a bunch of times, add graphics, add interesting things, add humor, make it more of a game than just an educational product, and maybe they can find some more success in that. And it turns out they could, and it was a massive runaway hit, and still used as an educational product, but it was designed more with the home market in mind. And that's what this article is about. And it's an interesting article, even for somebody like me who never played this game as a kid. I found the design ideas in it quite interesting, and the fact that the poor three schmoes who first did this thing seem to have been cut out of history. So sad for them. We will also have a link to an article because of that on CityPages.com about that original work, and I find that one really interesting, the original text-only version. And so those three guys who did not make a bunch of money off Oregon Trail, it seems, they wrote the original one. So hats off to them.
Very cool.
Yeah. Did you guys know that Oregon Trail was a remake? Am I just the only one who was out of the loop here?
I had no idea.
Oh, I knew. but part of the reason I knew, let's see, I'm pretty sure that they came from the college that I went to.
Oh, cool.
So I think it says there somewhere that they were from Carleton College, which is Carleton where I college. Went as an undergrad.
Yep. They were living together and doing degrees at Carleton College.
Yes. Okay. So
it could be that they actually wrote this thing and then they sold off the rights. So like, I don't know. I'm not saying that there was something like untoward done here. I do not know the history of this at all. It's something I'm maybe interested enough to look into. We'll see. But it was just news to me that there was an earlier version of Oregon Trail at all, that there was this earlier text-only version by completely different people.
Yeah, I think actually there is a connection between those people and Mech. They may have gone to
and
work
maybe
at Mech.
Maybe they're the guys who founded Mech. For all I know, they're like presidents of Mech, and they're like, dude, screw you, it's our game. Like, right. So it probably was something like that. So I'm not trying to imply there was like something untoward, and probably people listening are screaming at their audio players right now, saying, God, you know nothing. Hey, I'm here for color commentary, whatever. I just found it very interesting that there was an earlier version. That's the main thing. I did not know that at all.
Well, and I think it is interesting to hear from Bouchard about this, but because the one that everybody knows is based on the decisions that were made there, like how to do the hunting and all that stuff. You know, like this, because I think the original one was supposed to be like you just type bang or something like that.
Yeah, you type the word bang, right? That's it, exactly, to shoot things. And again, it was basically like a little text adventure, very, very straightforward. So.
Yeah. All right. I have no segue. Earl, more Commodore.
Yeah, a little bit more Commodore news, because that's what, I mean, let's face it, that's what people really tune into RCR for. So there's a Commodore 128 motherboard replacement, basically a new Commodore 128 motherboard that's being developed. First saw this in the vintage computer forums, and there's also discussion about this on a discussion board. There's a link over there to it, but it's in German. So as they mention on the VC Fed, you're going to have to use Google Translate or something like that if you want to read through it. But the upshot is it's a replacement Commodore 128, but it doesn't fit in a Commodore 128 case. It goes into a slimline Commodore 64 case, but it's a functional equivalent of a 128, which I think is interesting in a number of ways. I mean, first off, the 128 is more obscure than the 64 in the sense that, I mean, you're going to find a lot of people from our day and age who bumped into a Commodore 64. The 128, not quite as much. We're not nearly as many titles written to take advantage of the extra oomph that the 128 had. So I think it's fascinating, actually, that somebody's coming up with this replacement motherboard. I happen to love that particular model. I think it was one of the ultimate 8-bits that ever came out. Because you had the 64 mode, the 128 mode, which was like the 64 mode on steroids, and then also it could run CPM, which I really enjoy the fact that it can do that. And so people are excited about this. There's a website for it, but right now, sadly, it's not anything other than just a placeholder with the words that say coming soon. But if you really want to know what's going on with the development on this, you're going to have to go to that German discussion forum and let Google Translate be your friend. So just thought I'd point that out. I don't know exactly when this might actually hit the streets as a product, but that's definitely the intent, it appears, is for this to be something that gets released out into the wild.
I have a question about the Commodore 128. I can't even believe I used that sentence. is it compatible with a C64? Like, if you've got a 128, you can just run C64 software on it?
Yeah.
Or is it a totally different machine?
No. I mean, it's so compatible with the C64. It basically has a C64 within it.
Like a virus.
Yeah, exactly.
like a tumor or something.
But,
okay, cool.
You know, good. A good virus, like probiotics, right? Like, you're sitting at the Commodore 128.
The C64 is like a yogurt.
Exactly. And you type go 64 from the Commodore 128 mode.
I would never type that.
You would. You would type it.
You can't make me type that.
And then
I'll burn this place down first.
It would be excellent if it was like the entry point for that was 6064, so it just looked like Go 64.
It would be fun because you have to fool people.
So then the 64
what
splash
if you
screen
Go
comes up
for yourself. And I'm willing to type that. See, my counteroffer.
I don't think you really asked me the question, honestly. I think you just wanted to be able to riff on it.
One of the things.
Go ahead, Earl.
Take us back, Paul.
the reason I brought up was that I found a list. I've thrown it into the show notes. Like, I found a list of software for the Commodore 128. And I think of the Commodore 64 as like a remarkably successful computer. And it seemed very game-oriented as well, like a billion games out there. And I was surprised at how relatively small this list of C128s are. It's not like there's nothing on there, but it's in the, you know, it looks like maybe a couple of hundred titles, and that's it. And a very small number of those are entertainment titles, like are games, a bunch of Infocom games and a handful of other things. And like, they're all text-based. And I'm like, what's with the fancy graphics? So it seems like way more productivity software and database things and utilities and graphics. And so I was thinking, like, there doesn't seem to be much for this computer, but if it could also run C64 stuff, then it would be more useful. Because if the idea here is you buy this 128 remastered board, but it goes in a C64, then I guess the idea is you rip apart a C64 and you throw this board in and chuck out the original C64 thing. So you're going to be mutilating an original computer. I have no problem with any of this so far. I'm just wondering, like, once you do that, do you still have access to the Commodore 64 stuff?
You do. And so there's, you know, multiple answers to your questions. That was almost a Robin Williams-worthy riff that you did there.
But, mine is okay.
But I guess one of the big answers is that people who had, and, you know, it still sold millions, by the way, the 128, but a lot of the people that bought them just used them in the 64 mode. It was kind of like a 64, but with a little bit better keyboard or whatever. And that's because that 64 emulation mode was so good. It was basically equivalent to a 64 in that mode. Now, the technical reason why you wouldn't find as many games in that for the more beefy RGB graphics is because, and you got to dig into the details a little bit, so I won't bore you, but basically it was a slow interface to the 80-column/higher-resolution graphic capability that the 128 had. You accessed it through just two ports, so it's kind of like, hey, I got a Maserati, but I have to access it through the window of a Pinto to be able to get to it. So with that in mind, that explains why there weren't as many games and such for that higher graphics mode. It just it wasn't really built for that. It was more built for the productivity. I think also where it came out in the timeline of Commodore computers could explain some of it too. I mean, you know, we're talking later in the 8-bit world when the PC had already started to get something of a foothold into the business market. And I just think, you know, that the timing and the fact that you couldn't get super high frame rate gameplay with the higher resolution graphics meant that if you got it and you wanted to run games, you were going to put it in 64 mode. If you got it for productivity software, then you had 80 columns and good color and all that stuff. And that's why you see a bunch of productivity software out there for the 128. And yes, if this thing is the functional equivalent of a 128, you put it in a 64 computer, you'd be able to go into 64 mode and you wouldn't lose anything.
Yeah, and I was thinking with respect to, you know, possibly ruining a 64 in the process, that the advantage that you have there is that there are a lot of 64s out there compared to 128s, you know, so
we got our work cut out for us.
Yeah, it seems like it would almost be worse to destroy a 128 to put a replacement motherboard in there, right?
Yeah, but there's not as many of them, right?
So this C128 revised motherboard isn't available, but it's coming soon. So if we just start,
right, you can start destroying
64s en masse now, just to get ready for it, that would be a wise thing, is what I think the stance of the show is.
Yep.
Unanimous.
Exactly.
Okay, excellent.
Okay, it looks like I have the next thing. And this is actually just sort of a small note, I guess, but a little while ago now, it's mid-April, Blake Patterson put on his ByteCeller blog a example of using his Epson PX8 to log into the, the level 29 BBS. So he wrote a blog post that sort of talked about like how he put this together, and he's using the Wi-Fi 232, I think, to do this.
Yeah.
You know, he actually had to build a power supply, I think, because he had like lost his actual power supply or in something, and he had wired together a serial connection to connect it up to the Wi-Fi 232, and then he called level 29, which has actually got the capability of setting a terminal size of like 80 by 7, which is what this display is, and actually showed it.
Hey, now it's 80 by 8.
Oh, but the 8th line has commands on it.
Oh, so, okay. Using the status line. Yes, 80 by 7.
Yep. So, anyway, it was pretty interesting to watch. You can watch the YouTube video. In the show notes, I had put comments on it that it was set to light background music. It's very relaxing as you watch this. And I kind of went on a stream of consciousness tangent here as I was putting this together. So like there's also, I think a couple weeks later, Blake had another article about calling the level 29 on a virtual next cube, which he was emulating with the previous emulator. There's a previous 2.0 emulator. It took me, maybe everybody sees this immediately, but the rationale for calling this next emulator previous is that it's like next, right? But at any rate, there's an emulator that you can run on a Mac, which will, you know, emulate the next. And it's actually, it works pretty well. I've used it before, but I didn't realize that it had gotten all the way up to 2.0. So if you had not been following it closely, you also may want to upgrade this. But so he's got, you can compare calling the level 29 BBS on the next station and on the PX8. But it was only a screenshot on the Next, so there's no nice background music, so you can provide your own music. And so as I continued to go on this tangent, the music that I was suggesting, there's a song called "Party at the BBS" by Kiba of Akiba, and you can listen to that. It's not for everybody. it's pretty crazy, but at any rate, it's a very it's not light, you know, music to BBS too. And that tangent, I was reminded that, oh yes, actually, Kiba of Akiba, I had come across them before. I've come across them in various ways, but one of them, the one thing that I had come across them for was this song called "Oh, My Personal Computer Is Dead," which is a fairly insane video to watch at some point. So,
okay, that one I know. So, okay. So I was like, oh, okay. This all kind of ties it together for me then. Okay, cool.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, I mean, neither of those songs are things that I am likely to just listen to over and over again. But anyway, they're sort of amusing to see it at one point in your life.
Not relaxing music. I threw a link into the show notes for the Wi-Fi 232. Which is one of those things I do not have sold out. I kind of wish I had picked one up. And so just so people know, it's basically like this little thing that you can stick on a serial port, and it's a self-contained little web. Basically, it's a little computer emulating website or emulating web server, but your retro computer will see it as a Haze modem, and you can use it to do modeming stuff. And it's pretty swell. I think it used to sell for like $50 or whatever. And I think I missed out by not picking one up.
Mm-hmm. There's a competitor, other, you know, parallel device that's sort of similar, whose name I do not know.
Oh, I did not know that. I might go search for that then.
Yeah, I think we can probably find that and put it in
there.
It's
one of those things where it should have followed the normal rule, which I don't pick up a lot of stuff, but little things like this, when they appear, little dongles, little cards, you know, the CF card for the Apple II, like little stuff like that is only going to be produced in small quantities, and at some point they just stop being produced. So if you're interested, that's a thing to leap in and buy, partly to support, you know, hobbyists who are creating these things, but partly because it's probably a limited opportunity. And then you just throw it in a drawer and you have it for later and maybe never use it, and maybe it's a waste of money or whatever. Don't judge me. I kind of wish I'd grabbed one of these things. A little thing like this could have been a fun thing to play with if the mood struck me.
I think this became there's like a piece that became available or something, you know, that you could buy this at the hobbyist stores or whatever, the small little Wi-Fi modem that you could connect to some sort of microcontroller or whatever. So I think that's probably why this came to exist. You know, that's a couple of people figured out a way to connect that to a kind of like a retro port.
That kind of makes sense, and that's why there'd be a few of them out there. But I should go look to see what the concurrently developed one is then. Or maybe if a listener knows, write in, because I think I might want to pick one of these up.
Are they based on that ESP8266 chip? Because that's really popular in the electronics hobbyist world. It's a
really
microcontroller
too.
Yeah, it rolls right off the tongue.
Catchy.
Yeah. And it, you know, it's really an inexpensive part. Has Wi-Fi, has some microcontroller smarts.
Oh yeah, it's got a full TCP/IP stack and a microcontroller and Wi-Fi basically on a chip. Well, that's nice.
Yep.
Yeah.
Cool.
So, although I think this Wi-Fi 232 is one of the first ones to hit the retro computing scene, it's the kind of thing that it's not surprising that it would be created. I do have one. I have used it. I have called, I don't know if I've called Level 29, but I've called something with my Apple III.
Oh, he drops the Apple III card.
Don't say drop.
Or inches.
If you call a BBS with an Apple III, does it drop the carrier 3 inches?
Okay. All right. Okay. I think that's it. I think we can stop with
that's it for the show.
We can move on to the word from our sponsor.
To match the higher intelligence of the new Commodore 128, an Apple IIc would have to add 3 more 2Cs to expand to 512K, an extra keypad, 30 block graphics sets, color sprites, 2 more voices, 4 instruments, a cartridge port, a joystick port, and a Commodore 64. Commodore 128 personal computer, a higher intelligence at a lower price.
And we're back. So the host's retro computing gift idea once again falls to me. What I have selected here is actually, it's a super cheap thing. I actually don't remember how I came across this, but it's an Atari keyring. It is $5.99 plus shipping on Amazon. Well, actually, the one I've listed here says only one left in stock. I think that is not... These are findable. Maybe I'll find another link to put in there, because I got to the Amazon link from the actual producer of them. But it's a little tiny... it looks like an Atari joystick, like the 2600 classic joystick. Actually, I think the stick part is a little skinny compared to the dimensions of the real one. But it's a tiny little thing that is actually on a key ring. And it looks, you know, it looks perfect. It's just tiny.
Does it work?
I doubt it. I wonder if the button presses.
Because I would be so into this if it had a little USB port and it was like, just in case I got my Atari controller on me.
Yeah, I don't know. It says it's made of like, somewhere it said it was made of metal. Maybe that's just the keychain. The thing about this, it looks really cool, but I don't know where people keep their keychains, but I can't imagine keeping this anywhere where it's not just going to like poke you.
Mm-hmm.
All the time. So
some people do put big honking things on keychains, though. Like I don't, because but you're right, the shape of a, even though it's a little tiny one, the shape of a joystick is inherently pointy. If that's in your pocket, it's gonna either poke through your pants or poke into you,
right? Yeah, it's like having a little you know, like a keychain made of a push pin or something like that. It's like, what are you doing? But maker of this makes some other things as well. So there's the one that I should have had a link to. But at any rate, it's a little 2600. So it's about that same size, but it just looks like the Atari 2600 console. I think I picked this joystick because it you can use these on Commodores, right? So it's not, strictly speaking, exactly Atari 2600 only. But I think the Atari 2600 would be more comfortable in your pocket. Mm-hmm.
So. And also that little tiny Atari 2600 keyring, for all we know, that is the new Atari VCS that's coming out.
Could be.
Yeah.
This is a way to get it early.
Yep. Get it early. It runs just as much software.
Yeah, right. But anyway, looks kind of cool. You know, you could just put it on your desk and have people comment on it. That's also possible.
I'm looking at the 2600 console keyring, and that would definitely be more comfortable. And it's amazing. Like, it's amazingly detailed with the six little... It's a heavy sixer. And with six little switches, and that is adorable. I love old Atari stuff, man.
So I love the look of old grain Atari stuff. Dude, because I'm not looking at... Oh, cool. Very cool. Yeah.
Yeah, but it's Atari merch. It's an officially licensed product.
Yeah, I thought that was interesting as well, that you know, somehow they've got some kind of licensing, or at least they write on their website that they have some sort of licensing.
I can write that too.
Yeah. So that probably shouldn't set you back too far, even if you get both keychains. So you should have plenty left over for the eBay auctions. And Carrington, you can start off with the... Oh, this one. Yes, okay, you can start off with this.
Yeah, this made the news, or made the rounds on Twitter. Tape collection barn find. I have been thinking about cassettes lately, and they are so awkward and awful to use with retro computers. I mean, there was a reason why, as soon as you could afford one would buy a floppy disk drive of some sort, because they're just so much easier to use than queuing up cassettes. But there's something lovely about cassettes for both music and for software, like just the look of a cassette. And so this is just a big old Apple II tape collection, mostly of dupes, found in a barn. Maybe some of these work, maybe some of these don't work. Maybe there's something really obscure on here. Who knows? I just like the look of old cassettes. And they got lots of old cassette labels, high quality computer software as a label, and then you just write on it that it's Space Invaders or whatever. And it's just lovely. It's super retro. It's super awesome looking. And it's, you know, €20. And it, for some reason, made a big splash in my Twitter feed. Everyone kept talking about this cassette collection. I'm like, well, at least that's a thing to pick for the eBay auction. So there you go. One bid so far, €20. I did not bid. I probably wouldn't even want it, but I like the look of cassettes. I kind of miss cassettes. I think the single is going to make a big comeback.
Yep. So, I mean, like the Apple II really did not... I mean, so there was a relatively brief window and there was a lot of Apple II cassette stuff. And then, you know, and then the disk drive came out and everybody left it. But of course, all the Spectrum people and stuff like that, you know, they lived with cassettes their entire time, right?
Way bigger over in Europe than it was here. Cassettes were really the thing.
So Antoine Vigneault has been collecting a very large archive of all the Apple II cassette software. So he's been sampling them and making them available. And he's probably got the largest largest collection of physical cassettes and, you know, the largest archive of these that's out there. They're interesting as artifacts. This, what I think is interesting about these, so pretty much in this suitcase, there are, I believe, no originals. It's conceivable that there is something called O'Reilly Mine and Star Clones that might have been originals. The labels on these, I mean, it's ridiculous. It's like a white label with a stamp on it that not quite lined up letters that say O'Reilly Mine.
But that still could have been the original for O'Reilly Mine. Who knows, right?
Yeah, exactly. It's quite possible that a 1977 software author or company would have stamped it, like would have made this in their house with stamps, and that was the original.
Stamps that don't quite line up. Like the letters are like they stamped each letter individually, it looks like.
Yeah, exactly.
And then they stuck it in a baggie and they shipped it to you.
Yep.
Right.
And it's been downhill since there.
So some of these tapes are blanks, but so it is conceivable that there is an original in here, but almost guaranteed all of these are, they're basically, so what happened in the U.S. was you'd have these games and your friends would have games and you would go over to your friends' houses and you would copy them from each other and you'd go to school and copy
friends.
Them and whatever. Right, yes. Back in the days when they were friends. Before they hadn't all left you and your insane computer collecting hobby. But anyway, yeah, so so what we're looking at here on the cassettes, I'm almost positive, is basically that same thing. It's like wares traded among friends, you know. So, but what's weird about these is that most of these, they weren't originally cassette games. So these are games that, you know, among my friends, at least, were distributed on discs, like in single files that you could run. You know, you pack many games to a disc, so it save the media costs or whatever. So they're all cracked, put on a single file disc. And then it seems like they were then transferred to cassettes, so that you didn't, you know, if you didn't have the money to have a disc drive or discs or whatever, you know, that they were traded this way, I guess. I don't know. It's just weird that these are games that would never, they were not born on cassettes. They were put on cassettes.
Yeah, the whole thing is a very strange auction, and I dig it. I dig it a lot.
Yeah.
I'm not going to buy it, but I like it. I like looking at it.
Yeah, I think I'm kind of curious to know, like, if there were any tricks that were done in order to make, you know, Choplifter on a cassette. Mm-hmm. But so there was, I mean, originally, based on the names, there was some question about whether these are actually Apple II cassettes at all, because, I mean, like, these are things that, even though we know the names, they weren't cassette things. But now that we actually can see the labels, you can see that the directions are specifically Apple. You know, like, this is the thing. You type 300.2000R to load it. You know, I mean, that's Apple dialect. So, weird thing.
Yep.
Yeah.
I dig it.
But it's in the Netherlands, so that's, you have to take that into account. It would cost me $70 to do shipping, which already takes a big chunk out of what I'd be willing to pay.
Yeah,
right?
That's it. Yeah, the postage is really high outside of Europe. That's one of the advantages. Well, they've got PAL over there. Being in the Northern Hemisphere, you can use discs, because our discs spin the same way. Floppy drives in the Southern Hemisphere spin the opposite way. A lot of people don't know that. Little tip, pro tip for you.
No, I read that on Tesla's website.
Right, exactly.
But you'd have to read it backwards if it was on Tesla's website, because, you know, other side of the world. That's how these things work.
Indeed. Okay. It's funny, actually, that I'm the one that's providing all the non-Apple stuff. But, okay, Earl, you have the next one.
Well, it's interesting because we were talking about eBay. So here's a perfect example of many of the things that I like in an eBay listing. First off, this is for an Apple II GS computer. It looks like it's in pretty good shape, and it's working. And they actually show it working and indicate that it's working, which I really like. The ones that say, you know, might work, I don't know, I couldn't test it. I would never buy one of those. I figure if I'm doing that, I'm just buying your junk so that you can ship it to me, and then I can throw it in the trash, right, or recycle it. But another thing is the price on this. We're talking about pricing and how what I've seen two GSs go for that are in working condition, this seems like a decent deal for an opening bid of $80. And for me, it's shipping $35, which wouldn't be horrible for a 2GS. It comes with this Kensington,
accessory that sits on top of it, and it comes with the mouse. One of the interesting things I think about it is the seller explicitly says it doesn't come with the keyboard. Now, you Apple guys can help clue me in on this. Is this a standard ADB keyboard, like you could get another keyboard and plug it in and it would work, or were the keyboards for the 2GS specifically for the 2GS, so if you don't have a 2GS keyboard, you're out of luck? Or
no, you can use an ADB keyboard. The 2GS is a nice keyboard. I like it. I like the position of the caps lock key on it in particular, bottom corner, the proper place for one, tucked in the way, because the caps lock key should barely ever be used. So yeah, but you could plug in the old Mac ADB keyboard into it and it would work fine.
Okay.
Yeah.
Perfect.
It's the system saver that makes this expensive. Like, that would go be the real money thing here. I think it's going to go for quite a bit because of that system saver. They go for more than the $80 it's asking for.
And see, the thing about that is that's another thing that I like in an eBay auction is when the seller lists it for a reasonable price to begin with, and then the market kind of takes its course. People look at it and they, because, you know, so many things I see, you know, rare, they start at $400. The thing is not worth $400 in any alternate universe. Why did you list it at that amount of money to begin with? They're listing it at a reasonable price, and if it goes like you're saying, Carrington, then they'll get out of it what it's worth. It's just they didn't price people out of looking at it before they ever even got started. So this eBay auction for me checks off all of the boxes, and it's for a cool computer system that I actually would like to learn some more about as I go. Because, you know, talking about some of the ultimate of the last of the 8 bidders, although this is technically an 8/16 bidder, so I don't really know if that qualifies, but you guys can give me a reality check on that. But
it's
got
blast processing, so that's what makes it.
Nice. I don't know what that means. So I like this listing, and I think this is reasonable, and I'll be interested actually to see what this one winds up going for.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it turns out that this 2GS keyboard is somewhat sought after. I really like it because it's small. It's the smallest of the ADB keyboards. Because if you look at it, there's like no boundary around it at all. But I do sort of keep an eye out for that keyboard. This keyboard is not in the auction. So if the keyboard were in the auction, then it would be even more. It would go for even more. But the other thing too is those system savers, the 2GS system saver, which is a square that sits on top of the 2GS. It's basically a fan / power, you know, strip. They have on the bottom of them I don't know why they do this, but there's a sort of like a foam square at the bottom that's supposed to keep it kind of like stable or something, keep it from slipping.
It was supposed to. You use the right term. Those things just dissolve.
Yeah, exactly. They almost always turn into something super sticky. I have one of these that seems so far not to have dissolved that way, but I should proactively replace the foam strip.
Version of the system saver. I don't know if it was the system saver, but another sort of same thing. Little box that sits on top of the 2GS and then your monitor sits on it. But you could slide in two 3.5-inch floppy disks into it. Then the fan. I kind of prefer that version because you get a little bit more height with the monitor on these things. But the system savers themselves of any format, like that kind of thing, go for quite a bit of money. Like that itself would, I think, people might bid on this auction just for that thing.
Yeah, yeah. The one you're thinking of is the, I think it's called the Conserver.
That's
Engineering. Yep. Yeah.
That's it. Yeah, it's an 81. Right.
Yeah. And those I do not have one of those, and I, you know, like, they are hard to find. Those go for even more. All right. Let's see. Okay, so I'll move on to mine. I'm going to skip to, the first one I wanted to talk about was the Webit internet computer, which is a weird thing. I wonder if we've talked about this before. So this is another one of those things that's in Nova Scotia, Canada, by this seller that is listing a bunch of interesting things. It is a buy it now of $300. I don't fully understand what it is. It is some sort of like
it's a Chromebook.
Yeah, it's, I mean, it's basically just, you know, it's like a little thing that's supposed to get you on the internet, let you check your email or whatever. It's not supposed to be a fancy thing, but it has built into it a Commodore 64 emulator. And so this is at an era when it was somehow worthwhile to license Commodore 64 technology and sell it as part of your email device.
And I'll tell you that the Commodore community sees this as, kind of an aberration, like one of the first of many of the Commodore branded items that just, you know, we're trying to ride the coattails of the chicken head logo and people's nostalgia for the Commodore 64 and Commodore in general.
Aha. Uh-huh. So this is sort of like what happened with Atari or something, like that it lost its sort of essence, but the name went on.
Yeah, that's basically the sentiment that I read from the Commodore community, is that, you know, this was not widely lauded.
When would this thing have come out? Because it's serious. I mean, well, it's a Commodore emulator built in. It looks like the bottom half of a PowerBook 500 series, like the BlackBook. Uh-huh. Like, it's got that same coloring. It's got two buttons. It's got a trackpad. Like, it swears, it looks like you ripped the monitor off a PowerBook 500, and that's what this thing is. So it's totally using, like, mid to early 90s PowerBook series aesthetics, but it's a Commodore thing. The whole thing's very weird.
I don't know what year it came out, but it clearly had
maybe Apple completely ripped off the aesthetics of this thing.
Sure.
I hope so.
1998, is that possible? I think that might be when it came out.
Yeah, that makes sense, because I think the 500 came out in, I think, 94, plus or minus a year, something in that range.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, that sounds right to me. And the seller's wild guess that this was in the 80s is not right, because we didn't even have the World Wide Web in the 80s.
But again, everything came from this thing. Apple ripped off its aesthetics.
Yeah.
Netscape was just a complete copy of this. My gosh, these people should have sued everybody.
Yeah, yeah. They built Netscape Navigator based on this, is what I
heard. They invented the letter D. I mean, it's just so much comes out of this. It's amazing. Yeah.
The next thing I have is, I just found this auction kind of like ridiculous, but it is a Apple computer luggage tag. So it's, you know, it's what you would think. It's like a little square of plastic that has a thing that you can attach to luggage on it. It has the Apple logo on one side. But the way it's being described is, it might be the first or certainly an early model of the Apple luggage tags. So if you're collecting luggage tags,
I don't think
Apple,
this is an official Apple product. Like, that logo is very poorly printed. Like the offset.
Oh, you're right.
It,
actually, it is.
Look at this thing. It's like, there's no way this would have passed muster with Apple, their logo. Like, the registration is totally off on this printing. It might have the you know, the circle R, but I think this is a knockoff.
So it might not be real. Just, it seems sort of funny that it was being sold as an Apple luggage tag and that you would care about the addition.
Right.
Okay, the next thing, also sort of whimsical. I just picked one of many auctions for an issue of the Computer Shopper, and I think we've probably talked about the Computer Shopper in the past. It is it was basically, I actually thought it was free, but apparently it's not free. This one on the cover, the April 1985 edition, says $195. You can buy it for $50 if you want. and it was basically just almost entirely ads. So
I used to love to get the Computer Shopper. Oh my gosh.
Yeah, it was fun to read, but
yeah. Twice the size of your average metropolitan phone book. Lots of ads in there for, you know, you name it, computer components, software, that kind of thing. It was great.
Yeah, I wonder actually if they're even scanned, because I think there are a couple scanned. I don't think they're, I haven't found a whole like collection, but the idea of even scanning those is really just scary, because they really were huge.
Mm-hmm. And then to make them searchable, I'd love a scanned OCR searchable version.
Yeah.
Someone get on that.
But isn't it, I mean, like, normally a magazine will have ads in order to support, to pay for the production of the thing. And if you have a publication that is all ads, why does it still cost $195 to buy? Yeah.
Well, because anyway. the people that place the ad want to know that the circulation is real. Like, and a lot of times there'll be ways to get it for cheaper than the cover price, but they want to know if they say we have a circulation of 50,000, it's 50,000 actual people that have at least a little bit of skin in the game. So the potential buy, not just like, oh, we printed 200,000 copies and threw them on the side of the road. Trust us. So I think that's why. You got to have a cover price just for that.
Okay. I'd buy that. Anyway, I think it's, I would not suggest buying this or any of the ones that this seller is selling because they are very, very expensive, but it's cool to see them. And, you know, if you really, really wanted it and it was worth $50 to you, then yeah, go ahead. But please scan it if you do that. Okay. Let's see. Let me actually skip over to,
oh no, you got to do the Radio Shack one. I have comments.
Okay. Then the next one I have is the Radio Shack one. it's a really nice setup. It is TRS-80 Model 1 with all kinds of stuff. It's got some magazines. It's got the monitor that goes with it. It has some of the software, and it is a buy it now of $465, and to me it would be $128 shipping. So it's not cheap, but it is really complete looking. It looks almost nice. Some of the things have some wear on them that make them not quite like museum display quality, but it is really quite a nice set. Mm-hmm. Okay, so Carrington, what are your thoughts?
So I dig it, and I had a Model 1, so I've always got a bit of a soft spot to these. But two things jumped out in this auction that I really liked. One was it comes with a bunch of tapes, again, because I'm on the whole cassette thing. But the cassettes, for some reason, the names of these things struck me as funny, and it's almost like a code, because like what, you look at the one and it's like Frogger, Quick Watson, Blackjack Backgammon, Tigers in the Snow. Like, just, I feel like I'm sending off codes, and so I just really enjoy saying the names of these programs. But the main thing is, there's a, I don't know, I got some weird habits, and one of my habits is when I look at a listing, if there's a monitor or lots of reflective surfaces, it's really fun to see, well, what can we see in the background? So there's some really nice shots of the person taking the photograph of this, and you can see the reflection into the place, and you can almost make out like the other computers that are in there, and I want to enhance it, like it's gonna be like enhance, and I think there's a whole other collection behind the scenes in this that might be interesting to bid on as well. And tell them, in the subway tile reflection behind your monitor, I see you've got an Apple III. What's that going for? That kind of thing.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Many reflective surfaces in these photos, and so lots of hints to other things going on. So
it is so funny that you say that. Whenever I take a picture that I'm gonna tweet out or something like that, I'm always cognizant of trying to take the photo at a glancing blow so that, you know, and being cautious of what you actually see in the CRT. It's hilarious. People don't realize that.
Mm-hmm. And at least I bring up this one because in this photo, all of the photos we can see reflecting the person taking the photograph, he seems to be fully dressed. And that is not always the case with photos in the retro community. So this is a safe one to look at in this sense. But, you know, beware of other auctions.
Yeah. There are, like, if you look at the monitor, there's like a little bit of some of the silver's kind of rubbed away. And you know,
that happens a lot with those monitors.
Yeah. I mean, I think these things, they look really nice. I really like the color scheme and all this stuff, but it's like when you're actually touching them, they're really cheap.
Yeah. It's amazing. Really, it's the same thing with the Coco. Like this looks like metal, isn't metal look is like, I really like this era of industrial design for Tandy stuff, but man, you pick them up and you're like, wow, this is hardcore cheap.
Yeah.
I think they called it Mercedes silver. Didn't they?
Did they really?
This particular color.
I think that sounds right to me. Like there was something that was overselling it even in the name.
The Coco I had was like that. I had the Coco 1, which was that silver as well, but the terrible, terrible keyboard. And the big thing, one of my strongest memories of the Coco 1 is it looks so much heavier than it is. You pick up one, there's like, whoa, is this empty? It's remarkably light computers for their metallic look.
This also comes with There's a whole pile of these like TRS-80 microcomputer news magazines, or but they look pretty thin, but they're, you know, like mostly not water damaged.
It comes with a teacher's aid. It comes with a book on like with a bunch of programs. Like it's a really nice collection. Like it's one of those if you were interested in a like a Model 1 and you didn't have anything, this is a nice like one auction and you're done. Like you've got a nice Model 1 setup. I really like it. I think it was a good choice. Yeah. I mean, it's more than I'd want to spend, to be honest. But it's because it's still a lot of money. You got to be really into these things.
But it's
a
lot of money,
but they have a make offer, and that's one of the things on the buy it now auctions when they're at the higher price. But they have a make offer button. To me, is a redeeming characteristic of that listing. It's like, you know, you could offer them less. They might tell you no, but at least they give you the chance.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, shipping is expensive. It's a large chunk of the amount that you would have to pay.
You can see what, but shipping's expensive for a reason on something like this. You got the computer and a big heavy monitor that's basically like a television and a bunch of magazines and books. And so there is a lot to ship here. So for me, the shipping's $148 to get up to Canada, which, you know, it's still, that's a lot, but there'd be a lot of packing involved in this. And, you know, it is what it is.
Yeah, no, I was trying to say this in a way that reflected my belief that this is not unfair pricing, but it's still like if I were going to buy it, I would have to pay that much in shipping as well as however much the
it's located in Florida, so it doesn't say, but so that's another thing you can sometimes do with eBay is make an offer and say, look, I'm in wherever in Florida, I'll pay you your asking price, but can I just come pick it up?
Yeah, I mean, so it is somewhat expensive, but it has a lot of pieces, and I wonder if you were going to buy these pieces separately, if it wouldn't be almost that much anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So I also like on the tapes they have those the very sort of 1980s like these letter tape things, so like you punch a tape.
Yeah, and it's like that 3D label, like it's a labeler that really punches it out though, like you get that bass motif or whatever it's called. Like I really dig that too. Yeah, it's all super 80s. It's lovely.
Yeah. All right.
The best decade.
Right, indeed. Okay, so the next thing I was going to mention was there's a Norland speed term for Commodore 64 128, and I was hoping maybe, Earl, that you'd heard about these or know something about this, because it seems like what they claim it does is unlock abilities that your 300 baud modem had that allows you to transmit at more baud. And I kind of wonder what the underlying idea is. I'm wondering if it's like a compression algorithm, or if there really was, like, you know, obviously it does seem like if you're going to be playing around with speeding up communications, you're going to have to do that on both sides. And so I'm
true, and I have no knowledge of this or how it worked. Hadn't bumped into it back in the day.
Yeah.
But the thing is, there were those things like speed doubler and RAM doubler and disk doubler. You're like, that can't work. But it was just compression. It did. Like, nope, here you go. You got virtual memory or whatever. So maybe this was some little trick that was essentially effective, or maybe you had to use it at both ends or whatever. I've never heard of it before. But
yeah, no, it's okay. So it says Norland Speed Term is an intelligent terminal software package which takes advantage of a little recognized fact that most modems made today, though rated at a fixed baud rate of 300 or something, are capable of better bauds. Better
they
bauds.
They work out.
Yes.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think we're capable of better bauds also.
Not me, baby. This is pure Carrington.
I think, it's buy it now for $19.45, like $20 basically. It's there are six of them available. They are factory sealed, so we don't get to see what's inside.
But originally it was only sold for $10, so that's not much of a markup on the original price.
Yeah.
This wasn't a good investment for the original buyer, is what I'm saying.
Right. I'm almost curious enough to get one just to see what's in there, but I mean, it's probably a disc, right? You know,
it'll be a terminal program. Yeah.
So.
And it probably is, if you use this at both ends, it can talk to itself and has a bit of compression.
Right. That is almost certainly what is happening. Okay, so let's see. The next one that I have in my list, which I may stop with, is it's a iMac. Oh yeah, actually that does remind me. I want to back up to something that the system saver, the 2GS with the system saver that we were talking about before.
Mm.
One issue I have with that auction is that, I mean, like, I don't know for whom it's an issue, but it's great that it was started at a kind of a low. There's a bid now. Was there a bid before? But it was started at a relatively low $80.
Somebody must have heard us. Why?
Yeah.
What's it up to now?
Was it
still,
you?
It's at the starting bid, but
okay.
every time they write 2GS, they write the numeral 2 and the letters G and S. And so one problem with this is that the people who are searching for 2GS written IIGS, like normal people write it, are not going to find this.
Oh, good point.
And so it's kind of cool to see it. But the issue I would have if I were the seller is that it's quite possible that if it hadn't been for our wide reach in this podcast, people wouldn't see it and might not bid it up to what it's worth. But
wait, so it's not spelled T-O-O-G-E-E-S-S?
I like
oh,
it. Yeah,
that explains why I'm getting such low bids on my auction.
Right, exactly. So
that happens quite a bit. Like I'll see something listed and they'll do a weird spelling of 2E and it's like Apple, A-P-L-E space, the number 2 space, the letter E. I'm like, no one's going to find this. Like,
yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And that's where you find the deals.
I have searches, you know, for Apple 11 and stuff like that because you know, people find it grandpa's weird old thing in the attic, you know, that
yep, their
looks like an 11C to them.
Yeah.
You know, if you ever write a book on eBay buying techniques, Paul, I will buy it.
I will bid on it.
Yeah. Might be sort of an interesting topic to talk about, but anyway, so I was reminded of that partly when I looked at this auction that I was going to talk about, which is the, it's an iMac DVS-E, but it says, the title says, Vintage Apple iMac Blue. It's not blue. I don't know why they thought it was blue. Mac OS 9, my family number, and then they give, it's basically the auction title is not very good. But it's the iMac, I think it was basically in the second generation of these. So there was the very first one was this sort of blue, Bondi blue, I guess they call it. Then the second one had these slot loading.
Yep. These are actually good
CDs.
Computers.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it was a big improvement when you got to this one because you had the CD or the DVD thing in it. It was like a 400 megahertz, I think, and like a decent amount of RAM. And then this was a good computer.
Yeah, and of course this was when they were all these colors, right? You could have these different color ones, but this graphite one was the kind of like the special one in this round. So it was the faster of them. It had this more professional looking graphite color to it. And I had one of these and I loved it. I also had the matching clamshell iBook as well.
I kind of miss those.
Yeah.
I know it's like a big computer with a relatively small screen by modern standards, but I have a soft spot for this whole era.
Yeah. Yeah, and it may be nostalgia, but I really like the actual DVS-E, you know, special edition.
Yep.
Digital video special edition, I think is what it stood for. But and of course, like as I look around myself, I can see like three of them because of course, like because I liked it, I got it. And one of them got broken in shipping. I should have mentioned that.
Oh,
because this is just, I mean, like you can see how easily this could get broken in shipping. It's a TV made of plastic. Anyway, I guess I just wanted to point it out because it looked actually relatively cheap. It's a buy it now of $40, and the shipping that's listed to me, although it's not coming from very far away, but it's like under $20 of shipping cost, which probably underestimates what they should be spending on shipping.
Well,
but,
or maybe is indicative of how they intend to pack it.
Yeah, exactly. But
they're gonna just stick a label directly onto the glass of the monitor and hand it over to the post office.
Right. I hope not. I have one of these that I think is mostly like it's mostly unsalvageable just because it looks really crappy once you have cracks all over it. But anyway, if you happen to be in Madbury, New Hampshire, you could just go get it probably.
And isn't the, speaking of the iMac, isn't the iMac now like hitting a round number, like 20 years or something?
Oh, you're right. There was a, I've seen stuff on Twitter go by about this. Like I think today, May 6th.
That could have been a topic.
Yeah, that would have been all right. I think what's his name? Tim Cook tweeted something about it being the anniversary of the introduction of the iMac, and then of course all the cranky Twitter people replied like, you know, with
you don't have to say
snarkiness.
Cranky, you just have to say Twitter people.
Yeah. So don't read the replies, but there was a tweet.
Because I'm a fan of the iMac, the original one, in particular this one and a couple of the later ones. So, like, I like the iMac, but it was the G4 the one that looks like the monitor on a stick. With that is one of the all-time great-looking computers. My gosh, I love that thing.
Yeah. There's really there's a cool ad that they had. I don't know if it was in the British market. It may have actually been in our market, but it had a British actor in it, like at night walking by a display, a store display of these things, and the iMac was sort of following the person walking by and sticking out its CD tray at it.
Cool. I have a vague memory of that. Yes.
Yeah.
It would move. Yeah. Anyway, the G5, the next one, which was like kind of the beginning of the current shape, that which is just the big monitor thing, was okay, but I think the iMac peaked at the G4. I think that is the most lovely of the iMacs.
Yeah. Oh, I think we had a little Twitter discussion of this with Mike McGinnis, because he saved one. And of course, I didn't want to, I sort of stole his thunder, I suppose, a little bit by pointing out that like these things are just so cute, you can't leave them unsaved. I had gone to a recycler at some point. I never should go to recyclers, but there was a set of like 8 of them that were basically on their way to be destroyed. Oh. And so like I
of the,
came home
of the
with
G4s?
Them. Yeah.
Oh my goodness.
So that's why I have like a line of them on my shelves. But because I mean, I don't want that many, but the thing is that they really are, they just look sadly at you.
Yeah, but they also are like a good computer. Like I think it's a good balance of relatively small, quiet shape, but decent monitor and decent speed, and like I mean, just and fully self-contained and just and so lovely. Like oh my gosh, I would have something like that on my desk now. Like I think it's one of the great icons of industrial design when it comes to computers. I just adore that look.
I really actually like functionally, I like the fact that you can re-aim the monitor
easily. You can on any of the ones after that. let's get rid of that and just have it kind of tilt back and forth. I'm like, no, up and down. Come on, what the heck, man?
And you can turn it and not knock everything over on your desk and stuff.
And it just looks like in the original iMac, the G3, was a super friendly computer. Like that was his idea. Like it's pretty colors. It's all self-contained. You don't have to hook up. You basically just plug in a keyboard and mouse and you're done. But the iMac G4 is friendlier looking. Like it's got an anthropomorphism to it that is just adorable. Oh, I love him so much.
Yeah.
I could just go on. I'm such a huge fanboy when it comes to the G4. Yeah.
Excellent. Okay. I'll leave it. I think I will leave the eBay auctions at that point.
Sure, that's lots. So,
all right, and we can go to the closing discussions. And I see from the title that you put in, even though I can't decode the YouTube code, I know what this is.
I am obsessed with this series of Earl must know this because you're all into the Japanese stuff. So there's this gum. I don't even know what the gum is, Sakuro gum or something, and it comes in two versions, a pack of a bunch of small pieces of gum and one long strip, and they made these 11 videos that I am obsessed on about long, long man, just this girl who is dating one fellow who likes the little gum, but then she keeps getting drawn to the guy who has the big gum, and it goes to places you would not anticipate that a gum commercial could go to. It is funny. It has a twist ending. There are 11 of them in a series, and it's probably the best series of ads I've ever seen. It's got nothing to do with vintage computers, but holy cow, if you haven't seen this Sakuro gum ads, you are missing out and your life is empty. So forget everything else we've talked about. This is the most important thing in our show.
Well, it's very ridiculous.
You have now burned some more time of my life, I'm sure.
Oh, you haven't
YouTube,
seen these?
I haven't seen these yet. I'm going
to
go see them.
Welcome to the best ads in the history of everything. I'll
reciprocate by telling you that if you ever want to look at some roll on the ground until you suffocate, laughing so hard, vintage ads, look up Schwarzenegger Japanese ads. Arnold has some unbelievably hilarious ads that he did in the Japanese market that you will find them entertaining, I guarantee it. But I will look at these right after.
Excellent.
That's cool.
Yeah, but I couldn't resist bringing this up because I keep getting obsessed and going back and watching these same 11 commercials over and over again. I want it to be a movie series or something. It's so good.
Yeah, I wonder, like, I'm curious to know how they played out in real life, you know, like you see one day and then you see the next one, like the story develops as the weeks go on.
So good. And it ends so well. Oh my gosh. it's everything I could have wanted from a gum ad.
And who knew that you wanted so much from gum ads?
I was going to say, you know, all the years of my life watching all these, you know, gum ads and just thinking you could do more.
Mentos did pretty well.
Oh, that's true. These are better. These are better than anything I've ever seen. These are the best ads I've ever seen for any product ever in the history of everything. This is the stance I'm taking.
I mean, first of all, it's just a weird product to begin with.
They've got like a very
long chewing gum or whatever.
You want to get like a foot and a half long piece of gum, but whatever. I would buy this in a heartbeat. I want to start importing it. But there's a twist that it's not actually more gum. Oh, and then your heart breaks and it's so good.
No spoilers. No spoilers.
Yeah. Oh, there's multiple twists. There's like five. It's a series of 11 commercials, and there's got to be four or five twists in it. It's amazing.
Yeah.
So that's what I got going on. I just watch Japanese gum commercials now. That's my life.
Yeah. Perfect. Excellent. Earl, any sort of closing discussion from you?
Just a thank you to the people who have sent me emails or tweet replies or whatever regarding FPGAs used in retro computing projects. There's a bunch of them, and I'm, you know, collecting all this up and hopefully going to make a podcast episode on this and just find it fascinating. So thanks. And if you know of others, you know, shoot them over my way. Very interesting. These things popped up, FPGAs popped up in some places that I didn't know they were in, products I didn't expect it in, so very cool.
Yeah, well, we look forward to that podcast episode. Actually, both of you have delinquent podcasts. I guess I do too. It's hard to keep these things going.
I wouldn't call Retrobits at this point delinquent. I think it's well beyond that. I think what happens when the fine for your book is more than the book is worth? I think that's where I'm at. What do they call volcanoes that haven't blown up for a million years, but they're technically still not extinct? So I might surprise you guys. We'll see.
Yep. And I think Drop 3 Inches will come back. I'm sure of it. It's just it's hard to actually find time to do these things.
Hmm. But,
let's see. I don't know. I actually really don't have very much that I was going to say as far as my closing discussions. The academic year is basically just ending. So, you know, so that hopefully will give me some time to kind of catch up and do retro stuff. And Kansas Fest is coming up in the not super distant future. So that's about it.
I'm already looking forward to Kansas Fest.
Yeah. I'm hoping that I still haven't actually the deadline for proposing sessions isn't till the end of this month, and I'm counting
so many
on that,
session ideas, but, and I'm so, speaking of delinquent, oh my gosh, but they all involve me doing something ahead of time to make sure I can actually do my session.
Right.
I got to get on that.
Well, my problem is that I sort of feel like I need to do something ahead of time before I can propose it, and that's a recipe for not proposing anything.
Well, that's what I mean. Like, I've got stuff I've got to do to make sure I could do the proposal.
Yeah.
Because I don't want to just do the proposal, and then what if I never get around to the pre-work? And
right.
Mm.
Well, it's worked out for you before, right?
Yeah, and usually that's how I do it. It's like, hey, here's the thing, and I'll wing it. Let's wing it live.
Just like this podcast.
But I'm supposed to, I want to put more effort into things.
Oh, well. I guess that's probably basically it.
Awesome.
So, that's it for this show. That's how the final closing words begin. Here we go. That's it for this show. You can find the show notes for this and all the RCR shows at rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss us in the forums at vcfed.org/forum/forum.php. You can follow RCR on Twitter at rcrpodcast. You can join our Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/rcrpodcast. You can send feedback to feedback@rcrpodcast.com. And we are a member of the Throwback Network at throwbacknetwork.net. And please write a review on iTunes. That will help other people find the show. And so, until next time,
Retro Compute! Long, long.